The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here this evening to introduce Vivian Gornick. Critic, journalist, and essayist, Vivian Gornick is praised for synthesizing ambitious political ideology with intimately acute interior life in her 11 books. From 1969 to 1997, her columns in the Village Voice heralded the politics of the feminist movement. A bookend to the landmark 1987 memoir, Fierce Attachments, The Odd Woman in the City is a narrative collage of Gornick's meditations on friendship, urbanism, and literature. The New York Times calls it a slim book with big echoes, funny and elegiac and truth-dealing. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Vivian Gornick to the Free Library.
Hello. It's good to be here, and I'm glad for all of you who braved the weather to come out. This book that I've just written is a memoir. It's called The Odd Woman in the City, and it's actually a collage. It's made up of three strands of concern. One of them is friendship, a particular friendship, which will become quickly apparent, and friendship in general, as we experience it now, and even as it was experienced 100 years ago. So that's a theme of mine. The second one, most important, is New York City. It is essentially about my relationship to the city. And the third is my attempt to sort of account for myself as a late 20th century feminist. Okay, so I'm going to read. The book is composed, as I say, of a collage. It's many, many sections, short and long, and I hope that they all come together in a way that develops a narrative arc, which will not be necessarily apparent to you, because I'm going to read from all around the book just so that you get a sense of what the book is. You'll have to imagine that it all works together. Okay. Leonard and I are having coffee at a restaurant in Midtown. So I begin, how does your life feel to you these days? Like a chicken bone stuck in my craw, he says. I can't swallow it and I can't cough it up. Right now, I'm trying to just not choke on it. My friend Leonard is a witty, intelligent gay man, sophisticated about his own unhappiness. The sophistication is energizing. Once, a group of us read George Kennan's memoir and met to discuss the book. A civilized and poetic man, said one. A cold warrior riddled with nostalgia, said another. Weak passions, strong ambitions, and a continual sense of himself in the world, said a third. This is the man who has humiliated me my entire life, said Leonard. Leonard's take on Kennan renewed in me the thrill of revisionist history, the domesticated drama of seeing the world each day anew through the eyes of the aggrieved, and reminded me of why we are friends. We share the politics of damage, Leonard and I, an impassioned sense of having been born into preordained social inequity burns brightly in each of us. Our subject is the unlived life. The question for each of us, would we have manufactured the inequity had one not been there ready-made? He is gay, I am the odd woman, for our grievances to make use of. To this question, our friendship is devoted. The question, in fact, defines the friendship, gives it its character and its idiom, and has shed more light on the mysterious nature of ordinary human relations than has any other intimacy I have known. For more than 20 years now, Leonard and I have met once a week for a walk, dinner, and a movie, either in his neighborhood or mine. Except for the 2 hours in the movie, we hardly ever do anything else but talk. One of us is always saying, let's get tickets for a play, a concert, a reading, but neither of us ever seems able to arrange an evening in advance of the time we are to meet. The fact is, ours is the most satisfying conversation either of us has, and we can't bear to give it up, even for 1 week. It's the way we feel about ourselves when we are talking that draws us so strongly to each other. I once had my picture taken by two photographers on the same day. Each likeness was me, definitely me, but to my eyes, the face in one photograph looked broken and faceted, the one in the other of a piece. It's the same with me and Leonard. The self-image each of us projects to the other is the one we carry around in our heads, the one that makes us feel coherent. Why then, one might ask, do we not meet more often than once a week, take in more of the world together, extend each other the comfort of the daily chat? The problem is we both have a penchant for the negative. Whatever the circumstance, for each of us, the glass is perpetually half empty. Either he is registering loss, failure, defeat, or I am. We cannot help ourselves. We like it to be otherwise, but it's the way life feels to each of us, and the way life feels is inevitably the way life is lived. One night at a party, I fell into a disagreement with a friend of ours who's famous for his debating skills. At first, I responded nervously to his every challenge, but soon I found my sea legs, and then I stood my ground more successfully than he did. People crowded round me. That was wonderful, they said, wonderful. I turned eagerly to Leonard. You were nervous, he said. Another time, I went to Florence with my niece. How was it? Leonard asked. The city was lovely, I said. My niece is great. You know, it's hard to be with someone 24 hours a day for 8 days. But we traveled well together, walked miles along the Arno. That river is beautiful. That is sad, Leonard said, that you found it irritating to be so much with your niece. You all know him, I can say. A third time, I went to the beach for the weekend. It rained one day, was sunny another. Again, Leonard asked how it had been. Refreshing, I said. The rain didn't daunt you, he said. I remind myself of what my voice can sound like. My voice, forever edged in judgment, that also never stops registering the flaw, the absence, the incompleteness. My voice that so often causes Leonard's eyes to flicker and his mouth to tighten. At the end of an evening together, one or the other of us will impulsively suggest that we meet again during the week, but only rarely does the impulse live long enough to be acted upon. We mean it, of course, when we are saying goodbye, want nothing more than to renew the contact immediately. But going up in the elevator to my apartment, I start to feel on my skin the sensory effect of an evening full of irony and negative judgment. Nothing serious, just surface damage. 1,000 tiny pinpricks dotting arms, neck, chest. But somewhere within me, in a place I cannot even name, I begin to shrink from the prospect of feeling it again soon. A day passes, then another. I must call Leonard, I say to myself, but repeatedly the hand about to reach for the phone fails to move. He, of course, must be feeling the same, as he doesn't call either. The unacted upon impulse accumulates into a failure of nerve. Failure of nerve hardens into ennui. When the cycle of mixed feeling, failed nerve, and paralyzed will has run its course, the longing to meet again acquires urgency, and the hand reaching for the phone will complete the action. Leonard and I consider ourselves intimates because our cycle takes only a week to complete. Space. Yesterday, I came out of the supermarket at the end of my block, and from the side of my eye registered the beggar who regularly occupies the space in front of the store. A small white guy with a hand perpetually outstretched and a face full of broken blood vessels. I need something to eat, he was whining as usual. That's all I want, something to eat. Anything you can spare, just something to eat. As I passed him, I heard a voice directly behind me say, here, bro, you want something to eat? Here's something to eat. I turned back and saw a short black man with cold eyes standing in front of the beggar, a slice of pizza in his outstretched hand. Aw, man, the beggar pleaded. You know what I... The man's voice went as cold as his eyes. You say you want something to eat. Here's something to eat, he repeated. I bought this for you. Eat it. The beggar recoiled visibly. The man standing in front of him turned away, and in a motion of deep disgust, threw the pizza into a wastebasket. When I got to my building, I couldn't help stopping to tell Jose, the doorman, I had to tell someone what had just happened. Jose's eyes widened. When I finished, he said, "Oh, Miss Gornick, I know just what you mean. My father once gave me such a slap for exactly the same thing." Now it was my eyes that widened. We was at a ball game, and a bum asked me for something to eat. So I bought a hot dog, and I gave it to him. My dad, he whacked me across the face. "If you're going to do a thing," he said, "do it right. You don't buy someone a hot dog without you also buying them a soda." I shouldn't laugh. I have always lived in New York, but a good part of my life, I longed for the city the way someone in a small town would, yearning to arrive at the capital. Growing up in the Bronx was like growing up in a village. From earliest adolescence, I knew there was a center of the world and that I was far from it. At the same time, I also knew it was only a subway ride away, downtown in Manhattan. Manhattan was Araby. At 14, I began taking that subway ride, walking the length and breadth of the island late in winter, deep in summer. The only difference between me and someone like me from Kansas was that in Kansas, one makes the immigrant's lonely leap once and forever, whereas I made many small trips into the city, going home repeatedly for comfort and reassurance, dullness and delay, before attempting the main chance. Down Broadway, up Lexington, across 57th Street from river to river, through Greenwich Village, Chelsea, the Lower East Side, plunging down to Wall Street, climbing up to Columbia. I walked these streets for years, excited and expectant, going home each night to the Bronx where I waited for life to begin. The way I saw it, the West Side was one long rectangle of apartment houses filled with artists and intellectuals. This richness, mirrored on the East Side by money and social standing, made the city glamorous and painfully exciting. I could taste in my mouth world, sheer world. All I had to do was get old enough and New York would be mine. As children, my friends and I would roam the streets of the neighborhood, advancing out as we got older, section by section, until we were little girls trekking across the Bronx as though on a mission to the interior. We used the streets the way children growing up in the country use fields and rivers, mountains and caves to place ourselves on the map of our world. We walked by the hour. By the time we were 12, we knew instantly when the speech or appearance of anyone coming toward us was the slightest bit off. If a man approached and said, "How you doing, girls? You girls live around here?" we knew. If a woman wasn't walking purposefully toward the shopping street, we knew. We knew also that it excited us to know. When something odd happened, and it didn't take much for us to consider something odd, our sense of the norm was strict, we analyzed it for hours afterwards. A high school friend introduced me to the streets of Upper Manhattan. Here, so many languages and such striking peculiarities and appearance. Men in beards, women in black and silver. These were people I could see weren't working class, as we obviously were. But what class were they? And then there was the hawking in the street. In the Bronx, a lone fruit and vegetable man might call out, "Mrs., fresh tomatoes today." But here, people on the sidewalk were selling watches, radios, books, jewelry in loud, insistent voices. Not only that, but the men and women passing by got into it with them. "How long will that watch work? Till I get to the end of the block? I know the guy who wrote that book. It isn't worth a dollar. Where'd you get that radio? The cops will be at my door in the morning, right?" So much stir and animation, people who were strangers talking at one another, making one another laugh, cry out, crinkle up with pleasure, flash with anger. It was the boldness of gesture and expression everywhere that so captivated us. The stylish flirtation, the savvy exchange, people sparking witty, exuberant responses in one another, in themselves. In college, another friend walked me down West End Avenue. I'd never seen a street as wide and stately as this one, with doormen standing in front of apartment houses of imposing height that lined the avenue for a mile and a half. My friend told me that in these great stone buildings lived musicians and writers, scientists and emigres, dancers and philosophers. Very soon, no trip downtown was complete without a walk on West End from 107th Street to 72nd. For me, the avenue became emblematic. To live here would mean I had arrived. I was a bit confused about whether I'd be the resident artist intellectual or be married to him. I couldn't actually see myself signing the lease. But no matter, one way or another, I'd be in the apartment. In summer, we went to the concerts at Lewison Stadium, the great amphitheater on the City College campus. It was here that I heard Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms for the first time. These concerts came to an end in the mid-1960s, but in the late 50s, sitting on those stone bleacher seats July after July, August after August, I just knew that the men and women all around me lived on West End Avenue. As the orchestra tuned up and the lights dimmed in the soft, starry night, I could feel the whole intelligent audience moving forward as one, yearning toward the music, toward themselves in the music, as though the concert were an open-air extension of the context of their lives. And I, just as intelligently, I hoped, leaned forward too. But I knew that I was only mimicking the movement. I'd not yet earned the right to love the music as they did. Within a few years, I began to see it was entirely possible that I never would. As I saw myself moving ever farther toward the social margin, nothing healed me of a sore and angry heart like a walk through the city. To see in the street the 50 different ways people struggle to remain human, the variety and inventiveness of survival technique, was to feel the pressure relieved, the overflow draining off. I felt in my nerve endings the common refusal to go under. That refusal became company. I was never less alone than alone in the crowded street. Here I found I could imagine myself. Here I thought I am buying time. What a notion, buying time. It was one I shared with Leonard for many years. I grew up and moved downtown, but sure enough, nothing turned out as expected. I went to school, but the degree did not get me an office in Midtown. I married an artist, but we lived on the Lower East Side. I began to write, but nobody read me above 14th Street. For me, the doors to the Golden Company did not open. The glittering enterprise remained at a distance. After I graduated from college, New York meant Manhattan, but for me, New York meant Manhattan, but for Leonard, who'd also grown up in the Bronx, it remained the neighborhoods. From the time I first knew him, more than 30 years ago now, he walked the streets as I never had, into Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island. He knew Sunnyside, Greenpoint, Red Hook, Washington Heights, East Harlem, the South Bronx. He knew the meaning of a shopping street in Queens with half the stores boarded up. A piece of Brooklyn waterfront restored, a garden lot in Harlem full of deranged-looking flowers, a warehouse on the East River converted to a third-world mall. He knew which housing projects worked and which were a devastation. And it wasn't just the streets he knew. He knew the piers, the railroad yards, the subway lines. He had Central Park and Prospect Park by heart. He knew the footbridges on the East River, the ferries, the tunnels, the beltways. He knew Snug Harbor and City Island and Jamaica Bay. He often reminded me of the street urchin protagonists in post-war Italian movies, those handsome, ragged children of Rossellini's who imprint on Rome by knowing the city inside out. Leonard always looked like that to me when we took one of our long hikes through the boroughs, hungry as only a working-class kid can be for information. The kind of information that makes the ground beneath your feet yours. With him as my guide, the neighborhoods spread out for miles in all directions, often looking to my uninformed eye like wasteland, until I began to see them as Leonard did, an incomparable sea of ghettos, forever bleeding new life into a rectangle of glamour and prosperity. On these trips of ours, the character of time and space often changed as we walked. The concept of hours evaporated. The streets became one long ribbon of open road stretched out before us with nothing to impede our progress. Time expanded to resemble time in one's childhood when it seemed never to end, as opposed to time now, always scarce, always pressing, always a fleeting marker of one's emotional well-being. At a New Year's party, Jim comes rushing toward me. Sarah nods and turns away. A year ago, I was tight with one. 2 years ago, with the other. Tonight, I realize I haven't seen him in 3 months, her in 6. A woman who lives three blocks from me appears, her eyes shimmering. "I miss you," she breathes wistfully, as though where love is in wartime, separated by forces beyond our control. "Yes," I nod and move on. We'll embrace happily, me and all these people, not a glance of grievance, not a syllable of reproach among us. And indeed, there is no call for grievance. Like pieces in a kaleidoscope that's been shaken, we've all simply shifted position in the pattern of intimate exchange. Many of us who not so long ago were seeing one another regularly will meet now more often by accident than by design. In a restaurant, on the bus, at a loft wedding. Ah, but here's someone I haven't seen in years. Suddenly, a flare of intensity, and we're meeting once a week for the next 6 months. I am often reminded of the tenement friendships in my childhood. Circumstantial, one and all. Round, dark-eyed women filled with muted understanding for the needs of the moment. What difference did it make if the next-door neighbor was called Ida or Goldie when you needed someone to lend you 10 bucks or recommend an abortionist or nod her head during an outburst of marital rage? It mattered only that there was a next-door neighbor. These attachments, as Sartre might have put it, were contingent rather than essential. As for us, never before in history has so much educated intelligence been expended on the idea of the irreplaceable, the essential self, and never before has aversion to the slightest amount of psychological discomfort allowed so many to be treated as the contingent other. Samuel Taylor Coleridge worshipped a definition of friendship that embodied an ideal that could be traced back to Aristotle. Living at a time when persons of sensibility yearned for communion of the spirit, Coleridge suffered from its frequent failure to materialize in friendship. But the pain did not threaten his faith, not even when he lost the friendship that defined all others. Coleridge and William Wordsworth met in 1795 when they were respectively 23 and 25 years old. Wordsworth, grave, thin-skinned, self-protective, was even then steadied by an inner conviction of his own coming greatness as a poet. Coleridge, on the other hand, brilliant, explosive, self-doubting to the point of instability, was already into opium. Anyone except them could see that they were bound to come a cropper. In 1795, however, a new world, a new poetry, a new way of being was forming itself. And at that moment, both Wordsworth and Coleridge, each feeling the newness at work in himself, saw proof of its existence reflected in the person of the other. The infatuation lasted a little more than a year and a half. At the end of that time, the chaos within Coleridge doubled its dominion. The pride in Wordsworth stiffened into near immobility. The person each had been for nearly 2 years, the one who had basked in the unbroken delight of the other, was no more. It wasn't exactly that they were returned to the persons they had been before. It was only that never again would either of them feel his own best self in the presence of the other. One's own best self. For centuries, this was the key concept behind any essential definition of friendship. That one's friend is a virtuous being who speaks to the virtue in oneself. How foreign is such a concept to the children of the therapeutic culture? Today, we do not look to see, much less affirm, our best selves in one another. To the contrary, it is the openness with which we admit to our emotional incapacities, the fear, the anger, the humiliation that excites contemporary bonds of friendship. Nothing draws us closer to one another than the degree to which we face our deepest shame openly in one another's company. Coleridge and Wordsworth dreaded such self-exposure. We adore it. What we want is to feel known, warts and all. The more warts, the better. It is the great illusion of our culture that what we confess to is who we are. No, I hope you don't go home stunned by what I've just told you your lives are all about. No one is more surprised than me that I turned out to be who I am. Take love, for instance. I had always assumed that in this regard, I was like every other girl of my generation. While motherhood and marriage had never really held my interest, and daydreaming myself on some revolutionary barricade was peculiar among my classmates, I always knew that one day Prince Passion, with two capital P's, would come along. And when he did, life would assume its ultimate shape, ultimate being the operative word. As it happened, a number of PP lookalikes did appear, but there was no ultimate anything. Before I was 35, I had been as much bedded as any of my friends, and I had also been twice married, twice divorced. Each marriage lasted 2.5 years, and each was undertaken by a woman I didn't know, me, to a man I also didn't know, the figure on the wedding cake. It was only after these marriages were over that I matured sexually. That is, I became conscious of myself as a person preoccupied with desiring rather than being desired. And that development gave me an education. I learned that I was sensual, but not a sensualist, that I blissed out on orgasm, but the earth didn't move, that I could be strung out on erotic obsession for 6 months or so, but was always waiting for the nervous excitement to die down. In a word, lovemaking was sublime, but it wasn't where I lived. And then I learned something more. In my late 30s, I had an affair with a man I cared for who cared for me. This man and I were both drawn to the energy of mind and spirit that each of us felt in the other. But for this man, too, intelligent, educated, politically passionate as he was, the exercise of his sexual will was central to any connection he made with a woman. There was not a moment when we were together that he wasn't touching me. He never walked into my house that his hand wasn't immediately on my breast, never embraced me that he wasn't reaching for my genitals, never lay beside me that he wasn't trying to make me come. When after we'd been together some months, I began to object to what had started to feel like an on-automatic practice, he would invariably put his arms around me, nuzzle my neck, and whisper in my ear, "Come on, you know you like it." As I did genuinely love him and he me, we had memorable times together. I would stare at him at such moments, shake my head in exasperation, but then let it go. One day, he suggested that we do something in bed we'd not done before. I demurred. Next day, he made the same suggestion. Again, I demurred. "How do you know you won't like it?" he persisted, "if you've never done it." He wore me down. I agreed to try it once. "No, no," he said, "I must agree to do it 3 times. And then if I said no, it would be no." So we did it 3 times, and truth to tell, I didn't hate the physical sensation as much as I had thought I would. Almost against my will, my body responded, but I definitely did not like it. "Okay," I said, "I've done it 3 times, and I don't want to do it anymore." We were lying in bed. He nuzzled my neck and whispered in my ear, "Come on, just one more time. You know you like it." I hear that male laugh of deep familiarity. I drew away then and looked directly into his face. "No," I said, and was startled by the finality in my own voice. "What an unnatural woman you are," he exploded at me. "You know you want to do it. I know you want to do it, yet you fight it. Or is it me you're fighting?" Once again, I stared at him, only this stare was different from those other stares. A man was pressing me to do something I did not want to do, and pressing me in a manner he would never have applied to another man by telling me that I didn't know what I wanted. I felt my eyes narrowing and my heart going cold. For the first, but not the last time, I consciously felt men to be members of a species separate from myself. That's not man-hating, it's just separate. Separate and foreign. It was as though an invisible membrane had fallen between me and my lover, one fine enough to be penetrated by desire, but opaque enough to obscure human fellowship. The person on the other side of the membrane seemed as unreal to me as I felt myself to be to him. At that moment, I didn't care if I never again got into bed with a man. I did, of course, get into bed with them, love, quarrel, and bliss out many more times after this man and I parted. But the memory of that fine, invisible separation haunted me. And more often than I like to remember, I saw it glistening as I gazed into the face of a man who loved me, but was not persuaded that I needed what he needed to feel like a human being. In time, I came to know other women who would have analyzed the experience differently, but immediately understood what I was talking about when I described the invisible curtain. "It comes with the territory," most of them said, shrugging. They had made their peace with an arrangement that was as it had ever been. I saw that I could not. For me, it had become the pea beneath the 20 mattresses, an irritation of the soul that I could not accommodate. Work, I said to myself, work. If I worked, I thought, pressing myself against my newly hardened heart, I'd be a person in the world. What would it matter then that I was giving up love? As it turned out, it mattered more than I had ever dreamed it would. As the years went on, I saw that romantic love was injected like dye into the nervous system of my emotions, laced through the entire fabric of longing, fantasy, and sentiment. It haunted the psyche, was an ache in the bones, so deeply embedded in the makeup of the spirit, it hurt the eyes to look directly into its influence. It would be a cause of pain and conflict for the rest of my life. I prize my hardened heart. I have prized it all these years. But the loss of romantic love can still tear at it. A wooden barrier has been erected on my street around two squares of pavement whose concrete has been newly poured. Beside the barrier is a single wooden plank laid out for pedestrians, and beside that, a flimsy railing. On an icy morning in midwinter, I am about to grasp the railing and pull myself along the plank when, at the other end, a man appears attempting the same negotiation. This man is tall, painfully thin, and fearfully old. Instinctively, I lean in far enough to hold out my hand to him. Instinctively, he grasps it. Neither of us speaks a word until he is safely across the plank, standing beside me. "Thank you," he says. "Thank you very much." A thrill runs through me. "You're welcome," I say, in a tone that I hope is as plain as his. We each then go our separate ways, but I feel that thank you running through my veins all the rest of the day. It was his voice that had done it. That voice, strong, vibrant, self-possessed, it did not know it belonged to an old man. There was in it not a hint of that beseeching tone one hears so often in the voice of an old person when small courtesies are shown. "You're so kind, so kind, so very kind," when all you're doing is hailing a cab or helping to unload a shopping cart, as though the person is apologizing for the room he or she is taking up in the world. This man realized that I had not been inordinately helpful, and he need not be inordinately thankful. He was recalling for both of us the ordinary recognition that every person in trouble has a right to expect, and every witness an obligation to extend. I had held out my hand, he had taken it. For 30 seconds we had stood together, he not pleading, I not patronizing. The mask of old age slipped from his face, the mask of vigor dropped from mine. In the midst of American dysfunction, global brutality, and personal defensiveness, we had each of us simply come into full view, one of the other. A friend reads what I've been writing and says to me over coffee, "You're romanticizing the street. Don't you know that New York has lost 75% of its manufacturing base?" In my mind's eye, I stare into the faces of all the women and men with whom I interact daily. "Hey, you people," I address them silently. "Did you hear what my friend just said? The city is doomed. The middle class has deserted New York. The corporations are in Texas, Jersey, Taiwan. You're gone. You're out of here. It's all over. How come you're still on the street?" "New York isn't jobs," they reply. "It's temperament. Most people are in New York because they need evidence in large quantities of human expressiveness, and they need it not now and then, but every day. That is what they need. Those who go off to the manageable cities can do without. Those who come to New York cannot." Or perhaps I should say that it is I who cannot. It's the voices I can't do without. In most cities of the world, the populace is planted in centuries of cobblestoned alleys, ruined churches, architectural relics, none of which are ever dug up, only piled one on top of another. If you've grown up in New York, your life is an archaeology, not of structures, but of voices, also piled one on top of another, also not really replacing one another. On 6th Avenue, two small, dark-skinned men lean against a parked cab. One says to the other, "Look, it's very simple. A is the variable costs, B is the gross income, C is the overhead. Got that?" The other man shakes his head, "No." "Dummy," the first man cries, "you gotta get it." On Park Avenue, a well-dressed matron says to her friend, "When I was young, men were the main course. Now they're a condiment." On 57th Street, one boyish-looking man says to another, I didn't realize you were such good friends. What did she give you that you miss her so? It wasn't what she gave me, the other replies. It was what she didn't take away. As the cabbie on Sixth Avenue says, someone's got to get it, and late in the day, someone does. I am walking on 8th Avenue during the 5 o'clock rush, thinking of changing a word in a sentence, and somewhere in the 40s, I don't notice the light turning red. Halfway into the path of an oncoming truck, I am lifted off my feet by a pair of hands on my upper arms and pulled back onto the curb. The hands do not release me immediately. I am pressed to the chest of the person to whom the hands belong. I can still feel the beating heart against my back. When I turn to thank my rescuer, I am looking into the middle-aged face of an overweight man with bright blue eyes, straw-colored hair, and a beet red face. We stare wordlessly at each other. I'll never know what the man is thinking at this moment, but the expression on his face is unforgettable. Me, I am merely shaken, but he looks as though transfigured by what has just happened. His eyes are fixed on mine, but I see that they are really looking inward. I realize that this is his experience, not mine. It is he who has felt the urgency of life. He is still holding it in his hands. 2 hours later, I am home, having dinner at my table, looking out at the city. My mind flashes on all who crossed my path today. I hear their voices, I see their gestures, I start filling in lives for them. Soon they are company, great company. I think to myself, I'd rather be here with you tonight than with anyone else I know. Well, almost anyone else I know. I look up at the great clock on my wall, the one that gives the date as well as the hour. It's time to call Leonard. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, now, I know you're all dying to ask a question. You have to, whichever one of you wants to, you have to approach one of these people with a microphone.
I was particularly interested in your reference to Araby.
To
Araby?
Araby.
Yeah, Joyce is Araby.
Right.
I always think of Araby as disillusionment. Did you mean that, or did you mean...
Well, no, ultimately Araby is disillusionment, but the promise...
The promise, you've thought of it as the first
promise.
Part as...
Yeah, first okay. comes the promise, yeah, which every kid is attracted to. Yes, then it's ashes.
And I'm always left with the disillusionment.
So it
was
no
interesting.
Kidding.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That's interesting.
So you don't
bother taking the trip.
So I was glad to see that it was a different kind of way of using that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Does a current enthusiasm among writers and readers for memoir imply a mistrust of fiction, do you think?
It's not a mistrust of fiction. It's that, well, you know, it's a long story. It all has historical roots. fiction, first of all, realistic fiction was taken over a long time ago by modernism, right? So for many, many years, we have had in fiction precisely that sense of the existential fractured sense of life, out of which comes a voice, a disembodied voice. So if you look at modern novels, certainly from the end of the Second World War, you are listening more to, rather than getting an old-fashioned narrative, you're getting a disembodied voice that is registering the various senses of mostly alienation. That has run its course, and nothing yet has really taken its place. So what has happened now, since the end of the Second World War, we've had years and years of testimony, first from the Holocaust, from the war itself, and then the liberationist movements from the 70s, women, blacks, gays, and they all started telling a story in nonfiction terms. They're all, now many of these testaments did not become memoirs, but many did. And many of those memoirs did not become literature, but a few did. So writing memoir is an old, it goes back to the classics, to the ancients, one form or another. But in our time, it seems that the hunger for narrative, which never dies, always somehow reoccurs, has now come back to us in the form of the memoir, which means that just as 50 years ago, when I was a girl, all you wanted to do was write a great novel, now people do think of writing a memoir. And just as 50 years ago, very few wrote a great novel, a lot of lousy novels, so now you have a lot of lousy memoirs, if that's what you're getting at. But somehow or other, that is the genre of the moment. That's my take on it. I speak as if I'm describing this in tablets of stone from Sinai, but that's just the New Yorker in me talking like that.
I would love to hear some further details about your part of the Bronx. And I'm sure you're aware that it's not like Queens and it's not like Brooklyn. I mean, it's...
What, the Bronx?
Well, you know...
No.
Of course not. I mean, there are different parts of it that are as uniquely their own thing, but also being part of New York makes it especially sweet. And, I mean, you made it sound almost like you wanted to get out so bad that...
Not almost. What do you mean? Well, are you kidding?
when you crave to be back in New York, doesn't a part of you also back in the Bronx?
No, that is
good
romance.
Deli and some
oh,
of,
for
I mean,
God's
like
sake.
Every
well, first of all, they don't exist anymore. When I was a kid, the ethnics were Italian, Irish, and Jewish, right? And we made worlds out of that. We each had a different kind of neighborhood, but it was very much the same. Those ethnics have been replaced now by blacks, Latinas, Asians, I guess, too. I don't know, but I do know, you know, a lot of blacks and Latinas are now occupy the streets that we occupied. And I dare say they all feel the same way that we did. It was dreary beyond dreary. We made a lot of liveliness out of nothing, as they do too, as everybody does. Anyone who has a hunger to live, every kid wants to live. Even the grocer wanted to live. I mean, everyone makes life out of whatever the materials are that are given you. And I don't regret a second of, you know, any part of my life, because I was able indeed to make vivid use of it. Because we felt it deeply. But no one would want to, and it's a conundrum, it really is, because street life absolutely produces a lot of vividness that the respectable middle class doesn't. It's a trade-off, what can I tell you? You wouldn't want it back. On the other hand, it's a precious thing. Every element of the subcultures in you is a precious thing. It is true that people who grew up on Park Avenue don't seem able to make as much hay out of growing up on Park Avenue as we did coming out of working class Bronx, precisely because they had no street life. You know, that's what it means, no street life. So in a way, it was given to us, and those of us who had any gift at all to make use of it did. But I mean, it would be like longing for childhood, to long for it. And I might long for it if I long for having, you know, in that sentimental way of wanting to... Yes, the deli. I'll tell you something about the deli. Everybody had a Jewish deli in every neighborhood that was like mine. Ours was called Witkin's. Witkin's was owned by three big burly brothers who were all... They were like factory owners. They were ruthless, mean, miserable guys who exploited everyone who worked for them. And among the people who worked for them was a guy. Gee, am I doing right in using the real names? I think they're all dead. Anyway, there was a guy I'll call Sam. He was slow-witted. He worked for them all the years that I was growing up there. So, okay, we grow up, we go away, we forget about the Bronx. At this point, many years later, I'm living on the Upper East Side in New York for a minute. It was not my natural neighborhood, but for a minute I lived up there. And on Third Avenue, a restaurant opened up called P.J. Bernstein's, a deli, a Jewish deli. Well, upscale. It was an upscale, which is a contradiction in terms, right? But it was. There was a famous bar in New York called P.J. Clark's. This was a take on P.J. Bernstein's. So one day I walked into P.J. Bernstein's, and what do I see behind the counter? Sam, sprayed with age. He's looking 100 years old, but he still looks like himself. And I say, Sam. And he looks at me and he says, you're one of the Gornick kids, ain't you? I was 40 years old. You're one of the Gornick kids, ain't you? And I said, yes, I am. What are you doing here, Sam? He says, Dolly, the Puerto Ricans, they don't like pastrami. So there you go. That's the whole business with the Bronx.
Hi, I'm interested in process and when you write.
Aren't
and,
we all? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the process of you writing and the process of not being seduced by New York and all of its culture and so on and so forth. And I just want to know, you know, about your focus and your process of writing when you finally.
You have two things there: New York and the process of writing. What do you mean by process of writing?
Well, when you are in the process of writing, do you get up in the morning and take a walk and then sit down for 4 hours?
You mean my habits?
Yeah. Okay.
Not process.
It's not a process?
No, I mean, that's not a process. That's a really misleading word. It has become a piece of jargon. I really don't know what it means. Oh, my habits? Oh, that's easy. Yeah, I get up in the morning. I get up in the morning, I take a shower, I make a cup of coffee, I sit down at the desk. Okay. That's the end of the good part of the day. And I stay there. What can I tell you? I stay there, whether it comes or it doesn't come, whether I'm miserable or not, I stay there. And usually I can't concentrate for more than 15 minutes, and I'm up and I'm at the refrigerator, and then I'm back. And no, but the point is I get up and I do it and I stay there. If I didn't, that's the whole, there's nothing else to it, really. You know, you can imagine many other people writing books like this, but not this. You can imagine all kinds of other classes of people, people who are the beautiful young people, people who are have a wholly different sense of class, people who are and have a wholly different relation, people who are, I know many people my own age, who if they sat down to write this book, it would be one long piece of bitterness about everything that New York is no longer, what they were attached to. They might be writing sentimentally about the Bronx or something of New York as we knew it when we were kids and the world we thought we were going to live in, but it's all temperament. That's all. That's why there's no such thing as a subject. The subject belongs to everybody. It's just who you are.
Now my question to you, have you ever thought of have you ever thought with that gentleman who was having sex with you? Have you thought, oh my God, you know this guy is having orgasm over and over again? Did you have as many orgasm as he had? And did you think that was? Have you ever thought this is not fair?
This is a completely inappropriate line of approach.
It's a question of
a fairness, question, right? Question. No. You misunderstand my usage of this reference to sex. I tried to think of other ways to make my point, but this was too irresistible because it was so simple and it was so common to all of us. The question of power play in bed was a question of the power play between men and women. It was not a question of orgasms it's not about sex itself. The sex is being used in order to make a point about this struggle over power between people. Got it? Okay.
My question may go to a question of, I'm going to use that overworked word, process, but it really goes to, you started out saying your themes were friendship, New York City,
right,
and to account for yourself as a feminist.
Right.
When you sat down or began to write this, did you have in mind those three themes? How did they come together? And again, what
is
I'm
that
trying...
Is what you mean?
I don't know.
That's what you mean.
But that's what I mean. I want to know how they came together and then how did you structure it? I'm kind of getting, because I've recently read the situation in the story.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm trying to, and I struggle with myself, how do you take these themes and then tie them together to come up with a memoir that you're satisfied with? And how did you do that? How did you start that process?
Okay. The situation of the story, for those of you who are not familiar with that title, is a book I wrote And it's about writing what we're talking about. It's about writing personal essays and memoir. And the title refers to the fact that I stumbled on this equation for myself, in which I said the situation is the circumstance, the plot, the context within which something takes place. So, that, for instance, if I say to you, I wrote a book about growing up in the Bronx. Growing up in the Bronx is the situation. The story is whatever emotional wisdom I am really wanting to pull out of that. That is what a story is. That's what a book is. That's what a novel is. There's no novel that is about growing up in the Bronx. It is about hunger for the world. It is about incapacity of another sort. It is about whatever you want the reader to feel pierced by, whatever it is you want the reader to come away with, whatever, you got the idea, I don't have to go on with this. So, all right, so when I started this, I'll tell you as much as I know about it. For many years, I wanted to write a book about my friendship with Leonard. And for many years, I took notes. A lot of what I write in this book is pulled out of a bag full of notes that I've been taking for 25 years. I always came home and wrote down everything we said to each other for years. And I had all this great dialogue and all this great stuff. And I thought that was a story. And I started to write it, and it wasn't a story. It remained a situation. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know how to make it bigger than itself. For instance, Fierce Attachments, a book I wrote about myself and my mother, I had the same problem for almost a year. I didn't know what it was about until finally, at first I thought it's about how Mama and the woman next door made me a woman. In time I realized it wasn't, because it wasn't giving rise to more and more narrative drive. See, it's like, that's how you tell. There was no life on the page. It was just accumulating pages. I reread what I wrote and there was not enough there at all. So then I wrote and wrote and wrote, and finally I came to understand what I was really writing about, which was that I couldn't leave my mother because I had become my mother. My mother was so deeply inside me, and it was the thing that was retarding. It was the thing I couldn't leave behind and go forward with. All right, once I had that, I felt that was sufficient emotional wisdom. That was my wisdom, and I wrote that book to earn that. Understand? All right. So Leonard, I couldn't get there. I couldn't find the same way. I didn't know what we were about. And then one day, in the same way, I stumbled again on the city, which I had before. And I began to describe on the page walks that he and I took in the city. And somehow or other, putting the two of us together, we became the children of the urban, of the city, in my own feelings. And I don't know why, but it led me further. And then I put myself in, and I suddenly saw that what I was really writing about was the way in which people like us made use of the city in order to stay alive and in order to further our lives. This book is filled, it's all about really people who live alone, all about us, you know. I mean, never before in history have as many people of every stripe and condition, certainly of the middle class, lived alone as do now. In New York City, 50% of all households are single-person households. It's an unbelievable statistic. So who are we? What do we do? How do we live? How do we make use of the city? And then I began to read a lot of urban literature, and I had a great desire to add myself to the literature of the urban, which many writers have done over the last 200 years, and all men. So all the great writers, for instance, of the 19th century, Dickens and Gissing and Baudelaire and Walter Benjamin and all kinds of people who have fallen on the development of the crowd, which is only about 150 years old, and the development of the urban crowd, and what it means to lose oneself in it, and to find oneself in it. And we have the perfect, every world capital can supply this. And then when you read back, which I have in the book here too, Samuel Johnson walking the streets of London in the 1740s, a man of desperate depression, and knowing London in the 1740s, carrying smoking torches for light, men cutting each other's throats in alleys, coarsest of drunkenness, a ruthless, terrible city, and he's walking all night long talking with somebody who's just like him, who doesn't want to go home either. And of this he writes, "The man who is tired of London is tired of life." So it has a long history. And he finds himself too in it. And I felt myself, that's all I can tell you. That's how it came about.
I was going to ask something about your mother and fierce attachments, but because this is the last question, what part of New York do you live in?
Do I live in now? Mm-hmm. Greenwich Village.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. You've been great.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.